And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. We're going to start off with some music. And there is, of course, that old singer-songwriter from the UK. He's Scottish. His name is Donovan. And obviously he had a full name. I think it was Donovan Leach or something like that. But he goes by Donovan. And he put out a whole bunch of albums in the 60s and 70s that were very popular. And on his 1974 album, Seven T's, as in seven dash T's, as in tease somebody, T-E-A-S-E, there was a song on that album called The Voice of Protest, which seems apropos for our show Ecolibrium. So here is Donovan with The Voice of Protest from 1974.
The human race is sleeping. Half of us are weeping. Ignorance is creeping, darkening our way. No teacher is teaching. No plan is far reaching. The hawks of greed are screeching, poisoning our day. As round and round and round we go, the seeds of misery we sow. Round and round and down we go, your leader is lost and he don't know. Brother, sister, fear and mistrust making, giving not all taking, emptying the heart. The pain of not giving, pretending we're living, no one ever forgiving, the drama of the dead. The seeds of misery we sow. Round and round and down we go.
You may well ask,
which way to go?
Your leader is lost and he don't know.
More quantity and faster, directions to disaster, forgetting all we've learned. The children are surging, drug taking and churching, while the old earth ship she's lurching, all on her starry way. As round and we go, the seeds of misery we sow. Round and round and down we go.
You may well ask,
which way to go?
Your leader is lost and he don't know.
And that was The Voice of Protest by Donovan from the album Seven T's from 1974. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Welcome to the show. Last week, we spoke to JJ Corker from Nature Hudson all about an event that happened in Hudson last week, which was to raise money for Nature Hudson, but also show a documentary about putting together a biological survey of the Sandy Beach area, which is an area of high biodiversity in the Hudson area. just along the Ottawa River, kind of upriver from here where we are in Montreal. And I attended the event and was not able to record the panel discussion, even though I wanted to. I couldn't find the right cables to connect to the board. But I did interview a couple people after the event, and that's what we're going to play today. So we're going to feature two interviews, one with Marion McNair, who was the biologist that led the biological survey for the consulting firm Terra Humana Solutions. And after the interview with Marion, we have a small interview that I did with Frida Beauregard, who is the curator of the McGill University Herbarium. So that's coming up as well in the show. Both things are about Sandy Beach in Hudson and the importance of doing biological surveys in protecting natural spaces, which, of course, is an ongoing issue in the Montreal area that deals with so much urban sprawl and is becoming more and more a key environmental issue and something that we cover a lot here on this show, Ecolibrium. And so if you are in a community where you're trying to protect a local forest or a local wetland, there's probably some information in this show that might be of interest to you. And why, perhaps, if you haven't raised money yet to do sort of a more official biological survey that can be used even in a court of law to prove that an area has, species at risk or high levels of biodiversity. So we're going to start with the interview I did right after the Nature Hudson event finished, and that was with Marion McNair, who was the biologist who led the biological survey for Terra Humana Solutions. So here's that interview now. And this is Ryan Young for Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And I'm here with Marion McNair, who is a biologist who recently did work in the Sandy Beach area of Hudson to do a real biological survey to help groups like Nature Hudson, citizens groups like Nature Hudson, try and discover what was there that was interesting from a biodiversity point of view, and in that way help protect the area. How are you doing this evening?
Oh, it's great. It's wonderful to see so many people and to, get people talking about their stories and where they came from and their interest, and how much people care for forests like this, I mean, it's close to their heart, and it matters.
And so in this event that we've been at tonight in Hudson, there was a film screening. And tell me how this film came to be, because you obviously saw it happen as you were working on this project.
Yes, so we invited at Terra Humana Solutions, we were doing surveys of the flora and fauna in the forest, and we invited volunteers through the schools to come and help if they wanted to. And so a crew showed up, and they were great. I felt for them because, the first day was there were mosquitoes everywhere. They had missed the memo about wearing protective clothing, and I'm like, oh gosh, I felt really bad for them. I thought they're never coming back, and yet they came back, and Dylan turned over 50 logs looking for salamanders. The poor guy, he never stopped, man. He was so stoic. And Tiffan did these great interviews. She asked these great questions and brought out so much good information from the people she talked to, and built it on their own with their own motivation. It was delightful.
And so we'll talk a little bit more about the film, but maybe describe more what your role was doing this work.
I was just out there. So the way these surveys work is, there's not that much expertise in these areas, and it's expensive. And so it's hard for citizens who, have to take money out of their pockets to be able to pay a biologist who can charge a huge hourly rate. So trying to figure out how to do that and balance that, Terra Humana uses a bunch of different ways. At the time I was a student, so there was student money. You do different ways to do this. And I really appreciated that because it's so expensive. They have to come out, they have a minimum amount of time they've got to watch things, and then they're gone, right? And to be able to go out and spend the time, so, and to work with volunteers. So I would send off intriguing frog sounds to the herpetologist and bugs to the entomologist and say, so, would you like to come out and spend a day? And sure enough, man, we're all treasure hunters, right? They're like, a new spot, interesting animals or plants, sure. And so that worked, right? And they came out and, you know, these are people who can spot things so fast. And that sort of expertise is so helpful. And just being there was really important. So I went up and down and up and down, and I will watch the spring ephemerals come. We brought out people and sampled the vernal pools for the little tiny, there's like little tiny crustaceans in there. And they descend back down when the pools dry into the soil. The birders, oh my gosh, the birders. So one of them was here tonight, and she was amazing. You know, I call it bird o'clock, so you have to be there before dawn. That's so brutal. And I would follow behind her with my little notebook, and she just walked down the path listing birds that she was hearing. It was astonishing ability. These people are amazing. They should be canonized. And you just have to spend time out there, because initially I remember, you know, I'd go up and down and up and down. I wouldn't find anything. Or it's really standard stuff that everybody knows, you know, oh, there's trilliums. They're great. I love trilliums, but like, I'm not going to save it. But slowly, bit by bit, you build and you build and you build, and you get one species and then another and another and another. And by the end of it, you know, you've created a collection of things that many of them people didn't know were there. We didn't know they were there. You'd come across something and be like, what is that? And just spending the time and looking is really important. And I think it's really important too, because, you know, people, this is my forest and I love it and I want to save it. And, you know, it's valuable to me, but, you know, if you can hold up something that doesn't, it's valuable in general, right? It has these species in it. Then you have a clear picture of what's there, and you can hold that up to people. Says, you go in there, this is what you're destroying.
And I know that you found a quite rare plant, is that right?
Oh gosh, that's a whole story on its own. So we found, I forget how many rare plants, at-risk plants. So there's different levels of where plants are measured. Yes, we came. It's the most unprepossessing plant you can imagine. It's as near as I can tell, the common name is called the toothwort, and it's so rare it's not even mentioned, right? So, and you wind up out at the outer edges of botany here. So, you know, we tend to think that, you know, Linnaeus defined all the species in the world and that's it, it's done, but it's not. And especially with genetic testing, it's kind of thrown all the definitions up in the air, and there's a lot of things that we don't know. So, for instance, this species is circumboreal, so it's found in Europe, it's found all the way around. And so, but is it the same species as the one that's in Europe, or is it a unique one here? How do you make that line? We tend to think those lines are clear. They're not. So out on the bleeding edge of botany, you get these species that were like, well, maybe it's extremely rare and there's only been a couple of sightings in the province, or maybe it should be just folded in with another one that's, oh, you know, I think there's 5 sightings in the province. And it's very interesting to find. They become really interesting to the botanists, right? Because someone is going to have to go through and at some stage define those species, and that will be one that is listed, because it's found almost nowhere else.
And bats obviously they were discussing in the film how you have these monitors that listen, and bats makes very specific echolocation. I think it's ultrasound, right? It's probably above the level of human hearing, and therefore these machines, though, can pick it up, and then you can confirm a particular species, right?
Yeah, like a bird. You can tell from their sound which species it is. So it's just a particular microphone that's used to pick those up. Because, you know, you ever tried to figure out, see a bat, you know, all you see is this little wing flitting in the dark. And the only way you can get them is to put up mist nets. which is hard on the bats, and you need someone who really knows how to do that. There's not very many of those people around. So this way has just solved that, right? And that's actually happening in many different, so there's now machines that will record bird sound, there's apps that will record plants. It becomes much more possible to get an accounting without requiring this incredible expertise. You still need the experts to kind of, because things make mistakes, right? But it's expanding what we can find and how we can document, and we can know what's there much more readily than we could in the past. And that, if you know what's there, then you know what you've got to protect, right?
How many hours do you think, or how many visits did you have to make to the site?
Do I have to answer that?
You don't.
Well, you know, the joke was about how much at the end of the day, what my hourly rate was, and I won't say.
How did you get into doing biology? Because you had a career before, you were into journalism before.
I used to do your job. I still do a little bit of it. Well, as I said, I come from a wild place in BC, and I watch the starlings arrive and kick out the orioles.
What part of BC?
Northern Okanagan, so south of Kamloops, actually. Yeah, so, you know, there was so much nature there. And you don't realize at the time as a kid, right? But coming here, I was like, well, you know, where are the bears? But I wanted to, you know, you always want what you don't have. So when I got to Montreal, I was like all about the urban experience, and I became a DJ, and I danced all night long, and I became a journalist because I could discover as much as possible I wanted to. So I covered music for years, and but I found it, you know, after a while, I wasn't quite as excited about the latest band, and I wanted to make a contribution, and I wanted to feel that I was giving something back. And so I just started bit by bit working in outreach. I did like science shows for kids, and then I realized an English literature degree did not equip me to really do science journalism. So I went back to school, and I had this great privilege of taking community science data that had been uploaded to eButterfly, the website, and trying to see what we could learn from it, right? Because people make these contributions, and what can we know? And so I did a master's in looking at the habitat preferences in a hotspot that we had discovered using that information. It was such a great job. Like, I wandered from like butterfly location to ideal butterfly location and counted the plants and was able to determine several things that aren't known. And that felt like an amazing privilege, and in the process of that, I learned a lot of the botany. And then, you know, the Terra Humana was looking for a botanist and who could identify the plants, because that's one of the harder things.
Why are biological surveys important?
Well, they serve a couple of roles. First of all, is the ministry gives permission to develop a place, and it looks at what has been observed in that area. And the developer pays someone to do the ecological survey. My experience that I have looked at some surveys that looked really impressive and then gone up and followed where they went and went, they're blind or they don't know plants. So it seems to be a bit questionable how that works, I gotta say. So this allows us to send that information to the ministry. It becomes harder for them to issue a permit if they know there's a list this long of species that have been observed there that are at risk. So it's that, first of all. The second part, which is just as important, is people know what's there. So, you know, you can love a forest, right? But, and you can say, well, it's valuable. But if you know that it really is, you know, that there is this number of species there, and these species are in danger of disappearing if you take down this forest, that gives you an armament, right? And suddenly you'll be able to hold that list up to the politicians, to the municipality, and say, look at this. You know, yeah, I love my forest, but look at what you're going to destroy. Are you prepared to do that? Is that your legacy that you want?
I think that's a very good point. And so Nature Hudson was the organization that hired you. What was it like working with them? Were they following you around with bated breath or?
Oh, gosh, no. And, you know, given the number of mosquitoes in my job, I didn't expect them to either. I got caught in brambles last week. I was literally dangling off the ground, stuck. And I'm like, what am I going to do now? So they were really easy to work with. Like, they came out and, you know, we met them. And we came out and they would show up. Isabel of Terra Humana would bring lunch, and we'd all go down to the beach and we'd have lunch together, you know. And so whoever was around and could show up would, and that was great, just to kind of, you know, I would loved it, because otherwise I just keep working. And you know, we would talk about sort of, you know, what we'd found and the exciting things that I'd seen, and, you know, the different perspectives of the, in the history of the place as well. So I found them. Like, I can't imagine a better group of people. And I think a lot of the success of this rests on having those people there. Just, you know, a group who didn't quit and who found the different resources and kept at it till they made something happen. I mean, it's so easy to just despair. And, you know, because the most valuable thing that we have is time. And people don't have it. And so... someone who's willing to keep fighting and keep trying and try and put the pieces together to make it happen, that's a valuable community member.
And it seems to me one of the really spectacular things about this sandy beach area is the wetlands.
Yeah, you know, wetlands are special. There's just no denying it. They're, you know, the charismatic megafauna of landscapes. But... also, we're discovering that sort of in terms of the ministry, that's all they care about. So they don't want to know about the rare species up in the forest, right? The forests are okay. It's just the wetlands. You know, that you got to save as little as possible. And, you know, one of the things that we were looking at here was just how important, yeah, you've got your wetland, and it's like they're delightful places of great joy and full of biodiversity. It's just endless, the things you would see. And at different hours of the day, I would see so many different things.
And I mean, it's hard to divorce the wetland from the surrounding forest, right? They're all connected.
That's the thing that I think is being missed in terms of the development at the moment, right? Is, yeah, there's a recognition now, okay, you can't plow in these wetlands anymore, you got to preserve them. But now what we're seeing is, okay, so they define the wetland as narrowly as possible, right? And then everything else is fair game. So, you know, we're looking at a place right now that I'm like, if you develop here, you're destroying this wetland. It doesn't matter that you're not actually bulldozing it. It's gone, right? There's no way it can last.
Because there's just all these openings that happen for invasive species to come in. The hydrological cycle is disturbed.
Yeah, there's erosion. You know, the water changes. If you pave it and then you roof it, you've suddenly got water that comes flying off the edge of that place. It doesn't absorb in like it will in a forest and sort of trickle down. It's going to change completely all the water systems around a development. So,
and you were saying that the turbidity of the water can remove certain species from...
Yeah, there's a number of species that require clear, fresh water, and they just won't stick around. They won't survive if you don't have that. And interestingly, some of the more invasive species tend to do well in turbid water, which is part of the problem.
Okay, so maybe my last question is tell me a little bit about Terra Humana Solutions and what they do.
Their mandate is to try and improve ecological situation for communities, for individuals, for associations. They have done amazing work in a whole bunch of different fields. So they do heavy metal sampling in some of the native lands around here. They've done consultancies to municipalities about ways to improve their climate change readiness or their ecological footprint, and they've kind of trying to work together what Isabel, my boss, calls the pie. So bringing together what we did here at Nature Hudson. So bringing together the citizens groups, which is essential, right? Bringing together the legal aspect of it, the knowledge of how the permitting works, right? Bringing together the science, and you have to have all of those things together to kind of battle this successfully, because the citizens don't have that money, that knowledge. Nobody can have, like a big company, you know, can just call and hire people, expertise to do this. A little citizens group who has to pay out of their own pocket, they don't have that. So trying to find ways and find money and put that together so you have a toolkit for doing these kinds of things, that is the value that Terra Humana is trying to produce.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to me tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
And that was my interview with Marion McNair, who was the biologist who led the biological survey for Terra Humana Solution. If you are interested in finding out more about the research and consulting firm Terra Humana Solutions, you can go to their website, which is terrahumanasolutions.com. And Terra Humana is spelled TerraHumana. And if you want to find out more about Nature Hudson, you can go to their website, which is naturehudson.org. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Frida Beauregard also participated in the panel discussion at the Nature Hudson event last week, and I sat down with her as well to talk about the protection of places like Sandy Beach, why biological surveys are important, and also a little bit about the McGill Herbarium, where she is the curator. And the McGill University Herbarium was actually founded in 1856 with a gift of more than 500 plant specimens that were collected in the Montreal region in the early 1820s by A.F. Holmes, who was one of the founders and first heads of the McGill Medical Faculty. And then later on, McDonald College founded its own herbarium, which was called the McDonald College Herbarium. But then the two herbariums were combined in 1971, and all the plant specimens were then moved to McDonald Campus in St. Anne de Bellevue. And as a result of that merger, the herbarium numbered nearly 90,000 specimens, and it has since grown to more than 140,000 plant specimens that document the research activities of McGill staff and students over the past century. And they serve as a rich source of research material for biologists. So Frida Beauregard, who is the curator of the McGill University Herbarium, sat down with me to talk about Sandy Beach and some other topics. So here's that interview now. This is Ryan Young for Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Frida Beauregard, who is a biologist and the curator of the McGill University Herbarium. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks, Ryan.
So part of the reason we're talking is because Frida participated in a panel discussion last night, actually, in Hudson for the group Nature Hudson. All about the protection of Sandy Beach, which is a topic, of course, we've been following on Ecolibrium. And why were you part of that panel, Frida?
Well, I guess partly because of my connection to Marion McNair, who has just finished up her master's degree in the same lab, actually, that I did my PhD in. So we have a sort of a long connection as colleagues, as students. We are currently working on other projects together, and she was, you know, telling me how she was working in Hudson, which is really my hometown, my stomping ground. And although I don't live there right now, I live in Rigo, I still have tons of family, and I feel really deeply connected to the natural areas of the town. And so she was sampling plants in this area that I was so like connected to. I was like, oh, she's there, I want to be there too, you know. So she had some questions about some of the plants that she wanted me to glance an eye at, so we squinted at plants together, and that was how I kind of got connected to the group that was working on protecting the beach and the forest that's attached to it. It was really through Marion.
And she did find some unusual things there plant-wise, right?
Yeah, I haven't actually seen her final list, which I should really look over, but there were certainly some rare ferns in the area and some other things, and quite a lot of, not necessarily plants, but like the importance of the habitat for some amphibian species, for example, was really highlighted in the biological surveys that she made. So yeah, I would love to look over her final report, but I haven't actually done that yet, so something on my to-do list.
So nice. And so what did you feel you contributed, or maybe what you know, you could recall what some of the things you were saying on the panel discussion, the debate kind of, or not really debate, but discussion kind of revolved around why Sandy Beach is important, what are the best ways to try and protect it, the importance of doing biological surveys.
Yeah, it was a pretty wide-ranging discussion about conservation in general and how best to achieve conservation, and I got a lot out of listening to some of the other panelists, honestly. What I contributed, maybe I brought the conversation back sometimes to some of the larger biogeographic patterns of biodiversity, highlighting a little bit why habitats in southern Quebec in particular are very important to conserve. Because southern Quebec and southern Canada is really at the northern edge of the biomes in North America that it's part of, that they're part of, they're really important to protect because the organisms there are actually quite likely to kind of maintain their climate needs, their, you know, what their tolerances are going forward in the future. And so having intact, currently biodiverse places preserved is paramount in terms of buffering our ecosystems, our species against climate change. I think that was something that I contributed more maybe than the other panelists, but there were so many good points raised. It's hard to say what I contributed more than others, maybe.
But. You know, but what you saying that about how the importance of where a northern limit, or it could be the inverse, but where the northern limit of a particular biome, let's call it, or like a forest type, meets the next zone. And often in ecology, we always talk about the edge habitat and how there's an edge effect. And when two habitats meet, there's species there that exist in both habitats. I guess it's kind of similar when a northern region, the northern tip of a more southern region, meets its northern neighbor.
Yeah, it's true. And topography comes into play with that quite a bit, too. So you have, you know, say the Appalachian Mountains in the United States providing some different climate conditions than the more low-lying areas would provide within that broader geographic area. And so those higher mountainous regions have been important refuges for species throughout, you know, the fairly recent geologic past where you've had different glaciation cycles. So in the interglacial times, those have been historically places where organisms have, you know, been able to find refuge, continue to persist, and then recolonize other areas when the climate got colder again in general. And then so that cycle has happened several times, although the scale, obviously, in terms of the time, is very different. So what we're experiencing now is really rapid compared to what's happened in the past, which has been much, much more slow.
And with warming occurring in the climate, the northern tip of a particular species range is always pushing further north, right?
Yes or no. There's a lot that's not known currently about what causes the limits of different species. So I think that might be true for something like deer, and we would expect them to move like further north. And I know there's some concerns that they might encroach on like caribou territory, and there's, you know, different dynamics that'll start coming into play as different organisms that are really tied into climate will move, different diseases. It's really hard to see the future of where different ecosystems are going because there are so many different players. Like every species is playing a role in their ecosystem. So to predict how each one of them is going to affect all of the other ones is an enormous task. But certainly some plants seem like they won't change overnight, you know, especially things that are long-lived, like trees, forests. They're established in an area, we have to presume that they're going to continue to be there unless they have something that really is catastrophically too hard for them to get through. Like, you know, a few years of extreme drought might kill certain species, certainly. But that inertia is kind of built in because we have those communities of plants so firmly established, they're mature. There's nothing to say that, you know, there won't be some change, but there will also be a certain amount of inertia in the system so that that change should be gradual as long as we don't go in and do disruptive things like, you know, clear it, for example. That would be very disruptive for the community of plants and or other organisms that depend on them that are there right now.
And in your work as as somebody, you know, who's often dealing with students because of your role as a curator of the McGill University Herbarium, obviously you probably see a lot of students getting involved in these biological surveys to protect, threatened spaces in and around the Montreal or Southern Quebec area. Maybe less, but I mean, I know, for example, because I know some of your students personally, that, you know, even right next door to the McDonald campus, there is all of these natural areas that were threatened by development, and they've got urban sprawl all around them. Mm-hmm. And these are areas that you're studying, right? So, I mean, some students are using them to do research.
Yeah, definitely. There's, you know, the Morgan Arboretum, there's the McGill Bird Observatory that's collecting data on bird migration patterns. Yeah, for sure. There's lots of nice places to do research. The other thing that I would say about the Arboretum and those areas, and even the McGill Bird Observatory and Hudson Sandy Beach, they're all areas that are somewhat urbanized, and so the people around them really see the value in them as resources, as green spaces that they are using on their weekly schedule to have an experience, you know, like it's part of their lives. And I think that benefits the health of those people enormously to have the opportunity to have those public spaces so accessible within their area. And I think that's one of the reasons, apart from everything else that is important in preserving places like Sandy Beach, that they are really close to big population centers and they're still there. I think that's reason enough. Apart from everything else that's also super important, I think that's reason enough. People need green spaces. I feel like people in cities are like, you know, almost like animals in a badly designed zoo. You know, it's like they don't have their habitat needs met. It's affecting people's mental health. To be in a city without green space is not a nice thing. And there's tons of studies that have shown, you know, like life expectancy is affected by not having green spaces, by having fewer trees. All these things are linked together, and there's quite a body of evidence that shows the link between human health and having an access to a green space. It's really strong on all different health metrics. And even there's a pilot project now, I don't know if you're aware of it, in BC that's being supported by Parks Canada, where doctors can prescribe nature. They can write, yeah, it's awesome. I hope it is something that continues. It's called Nature RX, I think, and you get a free pass to all the Parks Canada parks, and you have to go, you know, like you have to have a log book and say, oh.
That's going to motivate some people to pretend they're sick.
I think at this time there is a limited number of passes available, and you do need to get a prescription from your doctor. And again, it's only in BC at the moment. So, I mean, like, I really hope it expands, because I think it's a fantastic idea. So it's things like, you know, depression, anxiety, cardiovascular issues, where there's such a strong link to spending time in nature being helpful, that, you know, if you have a patient like that, you can say, like, all right, you know, I'm going to use one of my passes that I have available, and I'm going to prescribe it to you. And, you know, you have to go twice a week, spend some time in nature, minimum of 20 minutes or whatever, you know, like, I think there's like a, you know, a certain expectation on the person getting the free pass that they go and actually take their medicine. I think it's a fantastic idea, and I think people in Hudson are doing this already, and in the region are doing this already by going to Sandy Beach, and it is a beautiful place to visit.
For sure. I guess another thing that I've been thinking about while you've been talking is doing these biological surveys and getting out there in nature. I mean, when you're doing it as a job and you're not going for a pleasant walk, what's it like trying to collect plants in the thicket and, you know, with the mosquitoes? And
Honestly, I grew up in a swamp, right? So unless the mosquitoes are so thick that you can't open your mouth without swallowing five of them, I'm okay with it. I think I got some great advice many years ago by a fellow who was a gardener in the local area, where it is very buggy, very lush and lovely area, the Como side of Hudson. And he was like, oh, you've got to just make your peace with mosquitoes, you know? And I always think of him, and I was like, I'm always trying. And I think I've succeeded more than most, but I'm not all the way there. It's always work to do with making the peace with the mosquitoes. But I love being out alone. I love, not feeling rushed. I'm always having a good time when I'm outside, even if it's crappy weather, even if I'm getting swarmed by mosquitoes to the point where I think I might be losing my mind. I'm still happy to be doing it, and I'm always saying to myself, ooh, I get paid to do this, you know, because it's the same kind of stuff I do for the fun of it.
Nice. And with your work, I guess this will be my last question. With your work as a curator of the McGill University Herbarium, it's an old organization, or it's an old part of McGill. I know the collection goes pretty far back. I'm just curious, you know, if you had any wish could be granted for the herbarium, what would you do with the herbarium in this kind of era where a lot of these museums are being, some people are saying, oh, that's out of date to collect plants and press them and, you know, look at them in a museum or whatever.
I guess, I mean, if I had all the time in the world and all the money at my disposal, I just would expand, and I would have a lot more people working on researching different aspects of the collection. Like you said, it's really interesting historically, and there's like so many questions that I would love to see brought to light a bit more. You know, like there's this fellow who collected plants on Rigo Mountain, which is close to where I live now, and I have also a strong connection to Rigo Mountain. I would love to have a study done resampling all of Quesnel's plants, you know, like all the places he visited, just see what's still there. You know, there's some protected land on Rigo. I'd love to do that project. I'd love to just take the time to learn more about him as a character. He was, I know, a genealogist and a historian, had an interesting life as well, and there's a lot of documentation. I'd love to do something on him. I'd love to do more on some of the different collectors. I guess, I mean, there's always things to do that are like physical with the collection in terms of like, organization and storage, and like, finishing off some projects that had been done. There's just so many different cool things in that collection I would love to do more outreach with.
And the collection has not been digitized, right?
There's a process of digitization underway, but it's not fully digitized, yeah. So that's something that's ongoing, for sure.
And then people could, I guess, potentially go to a website and look at the stuff?
Yeah, so you can go. So most biodiversity data that's been digitized or is being collected currently, you know, from direct observations, not from museum specimens, is all housed on GBIF, which I don't know if your listeners would be familiar with. So it's gbif.org. And you can look up all of the public data, which it's mostly is public data. And there's images, you know, so not just our herbarium, but many other herbaria have their images of their specimens there. But there isn't that curatorial value-added story. It's really, okay, here's the sheet. This is when it was collected, who collected it, what species it is. You know, it's really more like biological data. It's not that, like more museum experience of like, okay, who was this person? What did they do? You know, there's a lot of story there that I think really engages people a bit more than just looking at a specimen image, you know. So I think that is something that I would like to continue working on, is really making those stories and getting them out there. I have a graduate student who's working with me right now, and she's studying Dorothy Swales, who was a curator at the herbarium for a really, really long time. She had an amazing career. She had exchanges with scientists in the USSR. She was really interested in Arctic plants and their distributions and their uses. And so that's going to be, going to be a website add-on to what I've got right now. That'll be really nice to have. And I think, more stuff like that, more stories.
Very nice. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Frida.
You're welcome, Ryan.
And that was my interview with Frida Beauregard, who is the curator of the McGill University Herbarium. She was featured in the panel discussion that took place at the Community Center in Hudson that Nature Hudson put on last week. And we sat down after that to talk about Sandy Beach and biological surveys and other topics, including, you know, what her dreams were for the McGill University Herbarium, which is the oldest research museum of dried plant specimens in Canada, which is a pretty interesting fact. And they are located on the McDonald campus of McGill University in St. Anne de Bellevue. And you can find out more about them by going to mcgill.ca/herbarium. We hope you've been enjoying our show here on Ecolibrium today. And we're going to leave you with some music. But before we do that, we'll tell you that you can always email us with comments and suggestions at ecolibrium@ckut.ca. You can follow us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/ecolibriumckutmontreal. And you can look at our little website, which is ecolibriumradio.weebly.com, where we have a link to our SoundCloud page, and there's some old interviews there with people like David Suzuki and Farley Mowat. And we also have an affiliated podcast on Spotify, which is called the Ecolibrium Radio Podcast. My name is Ryan Young. Thanks for listening to the show. And we're going to leave you with the long song by the band Fish called Petrichor. And petrichor is the earthy scent produced when rain falls on dry soil. So I am sure you're very familiar with that smell, and maybe you never knew that that smell is called petrichor. So petrichor is the earthy scent produced when rain falls on dry soil. And this is a song by Fish called Petrichor. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Oh, Through Tree Canada's National Greening Program, native tree seedlings are planted across Canada, creating a widespread impact. Planted trees provide habitat, prevent soil erosion, and reforest areas that have suffered tree loss due to pests and weather. Tree Canada performs 1, 2, and 5-year assessments to monitor tree survival and ensure the trees planted are on track to meet the forest cover goals of the site. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
What time is it?
What time is it?
I can't hear you!
Time.
Oh, come on, now you can do better than that. What time is it?
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild, hitting switches, keep it right. The cypher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together. It's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio station and simply turn it on. CKUT, word is born, word is born. Y'all enjoy yourselves, love you Montreal. Tune in to CKUT, always.
This is why we are hurt. This is why we are hurt.